If you think about the basic physics of a pressure cooker, the whole mechanism is totally reliant on containment.
Right, exactly.
You apply this massive heat to a steel pot, the water boils, and it turns into steam. But because that steam has no way to
The
expand,
pressure inside just multiplies exponentially.
exactly, the pot looks completely still sitting there on your stove, but
Yeah.
inside, I mean, the molecules are violently slamming into each other. They're just desperate for a release valve.
And, the longer that heat is applied without releasing the steam, the more volatile that internal environment becomes. The energy has to find an escape route, or else the entire structural integrity of the vessel is compromised.
When you look at the commercial real estate landscape right now, it operates almost identically to that steel pot. You have these massive, restrictive macroeconomic forces clamping down like a heavy lid, and underneath there is just an ocean of capital violently searching for a release valve.
Yeah, that is the perfect analogy for what we're seeing.
So, welcome to this deep dive, brought to you by Eureka Business Group. Today, we are unpacking a massive stack of over 50 news items, research reports, and market updates. We're covering commercial real estate, net lease, and 731 exchanges for the first week of August 2026.
We're really sifting through a highly contradictory environment today. The sources highlight a market defined by a steady but selective paradox. High borrowing costs are anchoring the broad market, yet simultaneously, this massive wave of tax-motivated capital is desperately seeking a home.
Specifically concentrating in the Sun Belt.
Right, very targeted geography.
Whether you are an active investor mapping out your capital deployment, or you're just insanely curious about the financial mechanics of how the built world actually gets funded, our mission today is to give you a serious competitive edge.
Absolutely.
And because Eureka Business Group is the premier commercial real estate broker in the Dallas-Fort Worth market, specializing in retail, we are going to look incredibly closely at where all this pressure is blowing off steam in Texas.
But we really need to start by zooming out to the national capital markets first. The Federal Reserve basically sets the weather system for all these local real estate decisions.
Yeah, and the latest Federal Open Market Committee vote was a 9-3 decision to hold the federal funds rate at 3.50 to 3.75%.
And I mean, the hold itself was widely anticipated, but the structure of the dissent is what really caught the market's attention. Three officials, Hammack, Kashkari, and Logan, they dissented, but not because they wanted a rate cut.
Wait, they wanted a hike.
Yeah, they actually wanted a rate hike. Inflation is just proving to be incredibly sticky. The internal Fed models that previously projected a 2026 rate cut have essentially been scrapped.
Oh, wow. So that whole higher for longer narrative isn't just talk anymore.
No, it's not just a defensive posture, it is the structural reality of the capital markets right now.
And you can see the immediate ripple effect of that hitting property valuations. The sources note that CBRE just pushed its expectation for any meaningful cap rate compression all the way into 2027.
Which is huge.
Let's actually ground that concept for a second. A cap rate, or capitalization rate, is essentially the yield you get on a property if you bought it in all cash. So cap rate compression means investors are willing to accept lower yields, which drives the underlying value of the property up.
Exactly.
So CBRE is basically saying, if you're a seller holding your breath for property values to magically spike because of cheap debt, you are going to pass out before that happens.
Yeah, that is the mechanical reality. Because the cost of borrowing remains so expensive, the math to justify acquiring a property at a low yield simply does not pencil out for a traditional leveraged buyer.
Right.
If your mortgage costs you, say, 7%, you cannot rationally buy a building that only yields 6%, not unless you have a completely different motivation driving the purchase.
But this is where the sources present this massive contradiction, because my instinct tells me that if debt is this expensive and properties aren't getting cheaper, buyers should be sitting on their hands, right? Demanding massive discounts.
You would think so.
But the money is just flying around at record velocity. I mean, Delaware Statutory Trusts, or DST fundraising, just jumped 31%.
Yeah, the DST market is on track to hit a record $10 billion this year.
$10 billion. And on top of that, Orion and Secure Properties just launched a $500 million net lease fund. So to go back to the pressure cooker, if high interest rates are the heavy lid, something else is acting as the heat source.
The heat source is a tax code, specifically Section DENS 31.
Ah, right.
Yeah, the 1031 exchange rules survived recent legislative battles entirely intact. The mechanics of this rule dictate that an investor who just sold a commercial property has exactly 45 days to identify a replacement property.
And 180 days to close, right?
Exactly. 180 days to close to defer their capital gains taxes. That ticking clock does not care what Jerome Powell of the Federal Reserve is doing.
Just a relentless countdown.
Right. If an investor is facing a multi-million dollar tax penalty on day 46, they're highly motivated to buy, even if the interest rates are terrible.
I always hear bonus depreciation thrown around as a compounding factor here, too, especially toward the end of the year.
Oh, absolutely.
My understanding is that it acts as this sort of synthetic deadline. It allows an investor to write off a massive percentage of the property's cost in year one, which just creates this huge rush for buyers who want to offset their tax liability in the current calendar year.
That working definition is completely accurate. When you combine the rigid 45-day 1031 identification window with the end-of-year rush to capture bonus depreciation, you create a highly bifurcated market.
Meaning?
Well, you have billions of dollars that structurally have to be spent, colliding with a market where borrowing is incredibly expensive and inventory is really low.
So what does the fallout of that collision actually look like for a specific asset?
It creates a massive bidding war for a very narrow slice of properties. Overall, single-tenant retail cap rates ticked up slightly to 6.60% in the second quarter. But investment-grade product, meaning properties leased to national corporations with bulletproof credit.
Like a top-tier fast food chain or an auto parts store.
Exactly. That stuff makes up less than 10% of the available supply. We are seeing recent net lease comps that really illustrate this desperation. Like a newly built Houston Shake Shack just traded for $5.8 million.
Wait, almost $6 million for a single Shake Shack?
Yeah, and a Left Lane Auto in South Carolina traded at a 6.9% cap rate, and a Buffalo Wild Wings in Idaho traded at a 7.0% cap.
So a buyer is willing to drop nearly $6 million on a burger joint, accepting a relatively low yield just because preserving their capital from the IRS is more important than maximizing their monthly return.
Precisely. They aren't haggling over a quarter of a percent on the yield. They are buying a financial safe harbor.
Because institutional capital is fleeing the office sector, which, let's be honest, is undergoing a slow-motion existential crisis, and they're avoiding older retail product, this 1031 money is flooding into very specific geographies.
It's landing squarely in Eureka Business Group's home turf of Dallas-Fort Worth and the broader Texas market.
Which makes sense. I mean, the sources point out Texas currently leads the nation in retail development, driven by that sheer volume of capital migration.
Yeah, five markets in the state, with Dallas leading the pack, are in the top 10 nationally for construction completions over the last four quarters.
But the sources also point out a massive constraint on the supply side. Only 11 million square feet of retail was built nationally over the last four quarters.
Which is just a rounding error compared to historical norms.
Right. Construction debt is simply too expensive for developers to break ground on spec projects right now.
And the mechanics of that constraint are what's driving the Dallas-Fort Worth bull run. You have explosive population growth and robust job creation driving consumer demand, but developers cannot financially justify building new strip centers because of the cost of capital.
So it's a squeeze.
A huge squeeze. That fundamental lack of new space gives incredible pricing power to the landlords who already own existing well-located retail.
And the sources highlight some very specific transactions in that $3 million to $20 million sweet spot, which is the exact arena where so many private investors are battling it out right now.
It's the most active bracket.
Yeah. Phillips Edison just bought the grocery-anchored shops at Prosper Trail. Dunhill bought the Sprouts-anchored village at Camp Bowie in Fort Worth. But the transaction that really requires a deeper look is Westwood Financial acquiring the Southtown Crossing to Second in Burleson.
Oh, that's a fascinating one.
Right. It's 23,000 square feet, fully leased to tenants like Petco and Mattress Firm, and it sits right next to a Target. So why does a sophisticated firm go out of its way to acquire a relatively small strip center just because it shares a parking lot with a big box retailer?
Because Westwood Financial is executing a strategy based on the premium of shadow-anchored retail.
Shadow-anchored.
Right. They didn't just buy a physical building. They purchased merchandising leverage. By acquiring Southtown Crossing a Second, Westwood now controls 82% of the shop space surrounding that specific Target.
So they are essentially buying a monopoly on the retail oxygen in that specific micro market.
Exactly. Target is spending millions of dollars on national advertising and localized logistics to drive thousands of cars to that specific parking lot every single day.
And Westwood gets to basically draft off that immense gravitational pull without actually owning the big box itself.
Yes. And controlling 82% of the adjacent space is the critical mechanism there. If you only own a single 2,000-square-foot storefront, you are at the mercy of whatever goes in next door.
You have no say.
None. But by controlling the vast majority of the adjacent square footage, Westwood gains total merchandising control over the node. They can curate the tenant mix to ensure businesses complement each other rather than compete.
They can block direct competitors from cannibalizing their strongest tenants.
Exactly. For private capital trying to navigate a high interest rate environment, these multi-tenant, grocery, or Target-anchored strips provide some of the most downside protection available.
But we also have to look at the other side of the ledger. Because to understand what to buy, you have to understand what is failing. And the sources show a massive amount of distress in the system.
A huge amount.
The July report from KBRA indicates that retail CMBS distress just jumped 91 basis points to 9.6%.
Yeah, that's a significant spike.
Let's translate that for a second. CMBS stands for commercial mortgage-backed securities. It's essentially commercial real estate loans that are bundled into bonds and sold to investors. So the report is saying that nearly 10% of those bundled loans are now in severe trouble.
And this isn't just a matter of a borrower being 30 days late on a payment. A 9.6% distress rate generally means these loans are moving into special servicing.
Which is what, exactly?
Special servicing is essentially the intensive care unit for a commercial loan. A third-party crisis manager takes control because the borrower is functionally underwater. The servicer has to figure out whether to foreclose, restructure the debt, or force a sale just to salvage whatever value remains in the asset.
A near 10% distress rate sounds like a systemic crisis across the entire retail sector. But the data points to a very specific structural rot. This distress is completely isolated by vintage and format.
Highly isolated.
The sources show that loans against enclosed malls written in 2016 or earlier currently carry a staggering 96.3% delinquency rate.
Yeah, 96.3%.
Wait, really? That's also total default. We are looking at massive properties like Augusta Mall and Yorktown Center just being handed back to the lenders.
A 96.3% delinquency rate means that a pre-2016 enclosed mall is no longer a functioning real estate asset. It is a financial liability.
The physical obsolescence of the enclosed, cavernous 1990s mall is just total at this point.
Right. Consumers demand open-air convenience or high-end experiential destinations. The old format simply cannot be retrofitted to meet that demand without massive capital expenditures, which the current owners just cannot afford.
It's like buying a teardown property in a hyper-wealthy residential neighborhood.
That's a great way to put it.
You aren't buying the crumbling house. You are buying the lot, the utility connections, and the zoning rights. The building itself is just in the way.
Exactly. The physical structure is just in the way at this point. We are seeing developers applying this exact mechanic across the country. In Portland, the Lloyd Center is facing the wrecking ball right now.
And in Texas, the Ridgemar Mall in Fort Worth is being completely gutted and transformed into a logistics campus.
The financial mechanics of these distressed assets are fascinating because the land beneath these failing malls is incredibly valuable. When investors look at a mall with a 96% delinquency rate, they are valuing the redevelopment optionality over the obsolete building area.
Because most of these malls sit on massive parcels of land right next to major highway interchanges.
Surrounded by dense residential population.
Right. And the tenants inside these dying structures are really just collateral damage to the redevelopment play. I mean, most of the tenants at the shops at Willow Bend in Plano were just handed an August 31st deadline to vacate.
Which is brutal for them, but necessary for the real estate.
The developer isn't trying to save the mall. They're demolishing a massive portion of it to make way for a multi-billion-dollar sports and entertainment district anchored by a new Dallas Stars arena.
And that creative destruction is making way for experiential retail. Trademark's $135 million Anthem redevelopment of Lincoln Square in Arlington is a prime example of this. You also have Sky Zone leasing a 31,000-square-foot anchor space in Grapevine.
Well, you can buy almost any physical product on Amazon, but you cannot buy a trampoline park experience or a live hockey game online.
Exactly. You have to physically transport yourself to the real estate to consume the product.
So we have this massive flow of 1031 capital seeking safety in Texas, and we have developers bulldozing obsolete malls to build experiential and logistics hubs. But the underlying value of all these concrete and glass structures ultimately depends entirely on the consumer.
100%.
If the businesses inside the buildings can't turn a profit, the real estate is worthless.
And understanding the health of those businesses requires unpacking the current consumer paradox.
Right, because inflation is sitting sticky at 4.2%, which is a near three-year high. The cost of living is hammering the average household, and yet consumer spending remains incredibly resilient.
It's wild. The sources note that retail margins actually hit 5.8% in the first quarter, which is the highest level outside the pandemic since the year 2000.
There is this highly relatable hyper-local statistic that illustrates this perfectly. Houston families are planning to spend $800 on back-to-school shopping this year.
Wow.
While the national average is only $557.
Yeah, but you have to factor in the Texas tax-free weekend there. It plays a massive mechanical role in that localized spending surge.
Oh, how so?
Well, by stripping away the state sales tax for a three-day window, the state essentially engineers a concentrated burst of consumer activity. Families delay their purchases for months to capture that 8% savings, creating an artificial spike in foot traffic and conversion rates for the retailers.
That makes a lot of sense.
But if you analyze how that resilient consumer is actually spending their money across the rest of the year, the overarching theme is the trade-down effect.
Right. People are still opening their wallets, but they are hunting for value to offset the inflation in their grocery and utility bills.
And we see the physical manifestation of that trade-down effect in the real estate footprints of discount retailers. Higher-income demographics are aggressively migrating to value-oriented chains.
Like who?
Dollar Tree just raised its financial outlook and is actively planning 400 new stores. Ross Stores opened nearly 50 new locations in a two-month span across June and July.
That's massive expansion.
Yeah. Bob's Discount Furniture saw a 9% jump in sales and is expanding its footprint into two entirely new states. The discount sector is just absorbing the available retail space at an incredible velocity right now.
Now, my assumption would be that if you are a landlord, signing a 15-year lease with a rapidly expanding, highly popular brand is like the ultimate safeguard for your real estate.
It's a common assumption. But the sources provide a stark warning against treating a hot brand as a bulletproof real estate strategy.
Because the underlying corporate credit of the tenant does not inoculate the property owner against site-level risk.
Exactly. Look at the situation with In-N-Out Burger in Culver City, California.
Oh, right.
The brand has a massive cult following, incredible corporate financials. They attempted to open a new location, but they are currently locked in a brutal entitlement fight over a proposed drive-thru.
The local zoning board and the surrounding neighborhood are just fighting the permit relentlessly over concerns about traffic queues spilling into the street and disrupting local circulation.
And the mechanics of local zoning boards are completely divorced from the financial health of the corporate tenant. A city council does not care about In-N-Out's balance sheet. They care about traffic studies and noise complaints from the adjacent residential streets.
Yeah, they just want the cars out of the way.
Right. So if you buy a property relying on the cash flow from a drive-through concept and the city revokes or denies the drive-through permit due to traffic stacking, the underlying value of your real estate plummets instantly. You must underwrite the physical functionality of the site and its political durability within the local municipality, not just the name on the lease.
And you also have to underwrite the tenant's internal growth strategy, which can sometimes work against the real estate owner.
Oh, definitely.
The sources detail the Portillo's situation, which perfectly illustrates this mechanism. So Portillo's is a wildly popular Chicago-style food chain that decided to expand aggressively into Texas.
Very aggressively.
Yeah, they opened 12 restaurants in the Dallas area in just 3.5 years and another 6 in Houston over a 16-month period. What was the result? They just laid off 18% of their corporate staff and slammed the brakes on their Texas expansion.
Portillo's fell victim to market cannibalization. Now, from a corporate perspective, saturating a new market rapidly makes a lot of logistical sense.
It makes the supply chain highly efficient because a single distribution truck can hit 6 stores in one afternoon.
Right, and it maximizes the return on localized marketing spend.
But from the perspective of the real estate owner who holds the lease on just one of those locations, that corporate efficiency is a disaster. If you open 18 restaurants in close proximity, you aren't necessarily generating new customers.
No, you're just fracturing your existing customer base across a larger footprint. The store-level sales get diluted.
So if you are evaluating a retail asset, you must map the proximity of the tenant's other locations. If a brand is saturating the market, the specific box you own might suffer a massive drop in profitability, which obviously increases the risk of a future default, even if the corporate parent company looks totally healthy on a spreadsheet.
Exactly. It's a critical site-level analysis.
So if you are holding capital right now, the mechanics of this market demand absolute precision. You have this heavy lid of expensive debt restricting the broader market, while billions in 1031 exchange capital boil underneath, bound by strict 45-day IRS deadlines.
And that tax-motivated money is chasing a severely constrained supply of quality properties, funneling directly into high-growth markets like the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex.
And the structural landscape is shifting in real time. The obsolete enclosed malls are being systematically dismantled for their underlying land value, making way for arenas and logistics hubs.
Meanwhile, the smart private capital is finding safe harbor in shadow-anchored strips and value-oriented net leases.
It is an incredibly cutthroat arena. If you are attempting to navigate this specific landscape, particularly in DFW, relying on a premier broker like Eureka Business Group is not just a luxury. It is a structural necessity to access the inventory before the broader market even knows it exists.
Absolutely. And, you know, navigating this environment requires understanding how quickly the mechanics of leasing and acquisitions are evolving. I want to leave you with a final concept from our sources regarding the friction of transactions.
Oh, this is a great point to end on.
Right now, finding a property, matching a tenant to a vacancy, and negotiating a lease is a slow, manual process filled with friction. But Phillips Edison just launched a new AI-powered website that fundamentally alters that timeline.
How does an AI tool actually change the physical real estate market?
It changes the velocity of the information. The tool allows retail brokers to search for available space across Phillips Edison's 300 grocery-anchored centers using natural language prompts.
Okay, so instead of a broker spending weeks manually filtering through hundreds of site plan PDFs and making dozens of phone calls,
they can type a prompt like, I need 2,500 square feet next to a high-volume grocer in a market with 10% population growth, and the AI instantly matches the exact requirement to the specific vacancy.
Wow. If AI can instantaneously pair tenant requirements with landlord vacancies, the traditional lag time built into commercial real estate just evaporates.
The friction disappears, which means the speed of leasing accelerates dramatically. For investors and landlords, the velocity of the market is about to increase exponentially.
Meaning, those who hesitate or who rely on outdated manual methods to evaluate properties and source tenants will find themselves completely outmaneuvered by market participants operating at the speed of artificial intelligence.
Precisely.
The pressure cooker is only getting hotter. You either learn to operate at the speed of the new market or you get burned when the valve releases. It's a critical dynamic to consider as you underwrite your next acquisition. That wraps up this deep dive into the forces shaping the commercial real estate landscape. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you next time.